Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays. You're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like? Because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora. He's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Would it be?
The food is probably going to be the top priority. Probably just some gambling just to keep me busy. I think I'm going to go to the Cosmopolitan.
Yeah, the buffet at the Aria, the breakfast buffet at the Aria might get me, but I don't know that I can be anywhere where there's a casino. Is there like a monastery in Vegas? I don't think I could do it. I think I'd last a total of 24 days if I had to live inside. It is just insufferable. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, we're kind of getting down to it. I mean, this is where this is crunch time. This is six chefs. This is you can fit them around a table. This is you can't screw up. This is you can't outrun the bear much any longer, or you can't run out the other guy. The bear is going to catch you. So we start in bed.
Yeah.
Where all great meals start.
Yeah, Kevin, I just want to right off the bat here. Are they all sleeping in the same room? Did you notice that in this episode?
This is a note I have. What are they doing to these people? Why are there six rooms? Why does this look like the scene when Vincent D'Onofrio is going to get like hazed in Full Metal Jacket and they're all sitting there and why are they crowded together like that? It's a large house.
What happened?
I want to find this out because
it's disturbing. They're in a hostel. This I cannot stand for is six grown adults sleeping on cots in the same room. It sounds like hell. And, you know, we've gone through the gamut on sleep science and sleep studying and all that stuff for our jobs. And I have a hard enough time sleeping with someone else in the same room, much less five strangers, not five strangers, but five of my friends, I don't want to do any of that.
Well, to say nothing, if I want the room to be 65 degrees and if any of them have a problem with it, I'm out like right off the bat. So there's that. Yeah, it seems like clear violation of Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. It gave me the willies. It was further evidence I could never be on one of these shows because that in and of itself would render me insane. And I just would act out and I don't know.
Like, do you think the lease ran out on their house that they were at and they had to switch venues?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, is there a flooding in another room? Is it like they just want to kind of create the conditions for conflict? And this is one way to do it. It looked gross. It's just like all those people, you're breathing their air at night. I don't know. I'm with you. Like, it's amazing that I'm able to get up in the morning next to someone. And the idea of having to do it with five strangers is gross. Like, also, I have snoring issues. Like, I wouldn't want anyone to have to be in a room with me.
As a matter of courtesy.
Tossing and turning. I wake up. I just, I'm a bad sleeper. I know you're not supposed to be a bad sleeper. I know our friend Dr. Chris Winter, who has advised the Pittsburgh Pirates and Oklahoma City Thunder and San Francisco 49ers, says there's no such thing as a bad sleeper. So if he's listening, he would be disappointed in me, but I am a bad sleeper.
Well, you know what? That could actually be a strategy. If you're loud, but you're sleeping soundly, then you know what? No one else is getting any damn Z's.
No, I'm loud and not sleeping soundly. This is a cross I have to bear. So the other thing, it was breakfast in bed.
Yes.
Is something I also have a problem with. I don't like food in my bedroom. I have a lot of rules. I realize that. And I've come to just appreciate that I'm a guy with a lot of rules. I got a lot, kind of a Larry David, like sort of complex here. But I don't want food in my bedroom. I never want food. I will never accept breakfast in bed. If I'm doing room service, I'm getting over there, over toward the table or whatever. Don't food in bed. Ah, no.
Yeah. Is it the crumbs? Is it like a smeared ketchup? Like, what is it that that just rankles you, the idea of breakfast in bed?
I just need my bed to be like a Downy commercial. You know, just like the beautiful flowing whites, the faint smell of citrus and bleach. Like, there's just something I don't want any sensory shit like getting into my bedroom space.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like when you said what you just said, like the idea that there would be a condiment on the sheets or a crumb just kind of gives me the willies.
It just made you recoil, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it did. The minute you said it, it was like, ugh.
Like, yeah. Like, so
dollop of maple syrup, like whatever it is. No.
What I don't mind is having two double beds or two queens in my hotel room, and I'll reserve one as my table. Like, I kind of like the idea of having one bed as like, throw some clothes on it. You can eat there, like whatever. It's kind of.
No.
I'm a little bit of a, that bed is for sleeping and that bed is for just a mess. And so sometimes I'll just slap, you know, a bunch of clothes on there and lay them out so they don't get all wrinkly. And then I'll have like, you know, just sit Indian style in bed and eat my room service.
You know, I don't like the second bed if I'm alone because it's the broken windows theory. Then all of a sudden that bed becomes, as you say, like a desk and a dining room table. And the next thing you know, it's a bed with it enables bad habits.
Oh.
I mean, I'm just fussy. I mean, I'm no fun to live with. Seriously. Eric's a saint for doing it. But yeah, I don't like that second bed.
Do you like breakfast? Like, do you like breakfast food or room service? Like, are you a fan of that? Or are you a fan of you got to get out of your room and get the day started?
I kind of like, one of the things I like about those Kimpton hotels, I do like to kind of go downstairs and get my coffee. Don't get me wrong. Like, I like to have the pod in the room, but I do like to sort of, you know, kind of get going. The other thing is in the last year, Tom, since February, I've been intermittent fasting. So I don't really start eating until about noon every day, which is cut out something I do love, which is breakfast. So my body can stay in ketosis for 16 hours and it's working, by the way. Intermittent fasting works, Tom. Works like a charm.
Hmm.
So I have sort of divested myself of breakfast.
So this episode just totally is antithetical to everything you believe in. Breakfast in bed. First of all, the food being in bed just antagonizes everything in every bone in your body. Then the idea, the concept of breakfast. While you love it, you're not subscribing to that breakfast anymore.
Well, no, I just need to start eating dinner at 4. And then I could just have breakfast at 8, you know. That's really what I have to do, is just, you know, sort of have just eat dinner like a 91-year-old person who lives in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and just kind of have dinner at 5:30, up at the table at 6:15. Now I can have breakfast at 10:15. It's fantastic.
Wait, breakfast at 10:15 p.m.?
No, a.m.
Oh, okay.
I was like, you got like 16 hours. So if you finish dinner at 8:30, you can't eat till 12:30 the next afternoon.
Oh, okay. Okay.
16 hours.
There's a 16-hour rule. Okay.
16-hour rule. And I'm telling you, it works. I've lost much weight in quarantine.
Okay.
It is.
Didn't Oprah have a diet like that? Like, don't eat after 8 o'clock or something like that?
Yeah. She's a big don't eat late person, which I think is a generally good rule. Whether it's in conjunction with the sort of the ketosis thing or not. But yeah, like, I just think like those post-game meals we all have when we're working a series or doing the games, like, I mean, there's a reason people in the press room look like people in the press room. And it's just like, yeah, it's bad for you. Just bad for you.
So quick fire is breakfast in bed, obviously. And what did you think about that quick fire challenge? It seemed like pretty fitting for Vegas.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good challenge. Really what it is breakfast. I mean, here's the question. Is there any variable introduced in the decision-making of these chefs? Like, well, that would be a good breakfast, but not a good breakfast in bed.
Yes.
So like, not to make a mess. What did you see there?
No, it's the temperature. It's something that it would be able to stay for that trek up to the room, the room service. You put it in a platter, put the top on it. And if it's something that needs to be steaming hot, and I'm surprised Kevin was able to pull this off, because what Robin said was that you had to go up 2 elevators, walk across here, go across that jetway, all this, and then that, and then this, and then finally you arrive at the destination, and everything might have just gone cold. So I think the idea of breakfast, yes, fundamentally it's a breakfast challenge, but also I worried for those who had something that was piping hot or supposed to be eaten piping hot because of that travel. Now, apparently, maybe they had some, you know, heat lamps or something to keep that warm, because it didn't seem to be a problem for Kevin. But yeah, I think that was, for me, the big issue is, you know, having to put that I don't know what you call it, the little
silver thing. I don't know what it's called.
Either. Yeah, a little top, and make sure that your dish doesn't just go stale or rotten.
By the way, Miguel Lawson, very fun. Very, very fun. By the way, true story, at the time, was married to Charles Saatchi.
Really?
Who, obviously founder of Saatchi & Saatchi, nice Sephardic Jew. They have one of the best art collections, contemporary art collections in the world. So she was married to Saatchi for 10 years, right? From 03 to 13. Did not know this. She was charming. I have to say, they need to bring more Brits back on the show. It's been a while. But between her and Toby Young, whose mind thinks like a New York Post, like, headline writer. Yes. And I love that. I loved her. I'm really... Let's put it this way. I think they do good job on the guests now. I don't think they've done great job. They've done a great job with the guests in perpetuity. Like, they've always done great with the guest judges. From the Bourdain days, may rest in peace, this, Toby Young. I mean, Gail's obviously a fixture, but...
Not anymore, Kevin. Have you noticed? Gail has been absent except for last episode. She was gone for a while. And was she on this episode?
Well, no, but my point is like, over the course of the entire show.
Yes.
Like, the entire series, right? 17
yes,
years.
Yes.
So they've always done a great job. And this is just yet another example of just somebody I absolutely loved in that capacity.
You know what's funny, Kevin? A lot of people, when they hear that I'm a big Top Chef fan, they always mention the Great British Baking Show.
And I've never seen this. I'm not a baker. Not a baker.
But I guess the show, if there's a Venn diagram or an algorithm of Top Chef fans, apparently this is like the thing, the gateway from Top Chef into the Great British Bake Off. I think actually Brian Windhorst.
Brian, I was about to say, you know who was the last person to tell me about this is Brian Windhorst.
Yeah. And so I think if you're really tickled by British judges or just the British you know, food show. Maybe that's something we need to think about, is just dabbling in the Great British Bake Off. Maybe she's on that show. Maybe Toby is on that show too. I don't know. I've never watched a second of that show, but I'm with you. I loved her on this episode. I thought she had some terminology that I actually never heard of before, but she was great at describing very succinctly these dishes. And I actually liked when she was just like afraid to eat something, and she was right. She was spot on a lot of these intuitions. And so I thought she was delightful. So Eli comes up with Robin first, and Robin delivers what's called a blintz. Never heard of it before. What's a blintz?
Oh, blintz. So a blintz is basically...
Is it an omelet?
No. It's a crepe. It's like a rolled crepe, and inside... So all right. So there are two kinds of blintzes. There are savory blintzes and sweet blintzes. So in my household growing up, the first night of Rosh Hashanah, my mom cooked for like 50 family members and like always made meat blintzes. So imagine like a crepe kind of rolled up. So it almost looks like a mini burrito. So in terms of like it looks like a roti or a mini burrito. It's kind of smaller. And there's like sort of ground beef with onion and just that was sort of a meat blintz. And that was my mom's signature meal first night of Rosh Hashanah for like fucking 40 years. Okay.
Okay.
Now, most blintzes you find on at a Sunday brunch, they have kind of sweet sour cream filling with like fruit.
Mm.
Okay. And that was very much in the spirit of what Robin was doing. Now, Robin's blintz looks a little different than my mom's blintz, but it is. It's sort of a sour cream, fruit-filled rolled crepe, if you will. So that's what she did, and she didn't do it well, which is no surprise.
Yeah. I didn't hear, do you like blintzes?
Yeah. I mean, what's not to like? What's not to like?
I don't know, but the sour cream filling doesn't really jump off the page for me.
Yeah, but sour cream has a different place in the Jewish culinary tradition.
Okay.
Like, you'd use it just for, like on fucking nachos. Like we use it on everything, like cured fish and with fruit and latkes. Like sour cream is the sour cream of Jewish culinary tradition. Like it's just it's a major, major piece of connective tissue for Jewish cooking.
Well, they didn't
in the dairy variety. Yeah,
they would have much rather have your mother's blitz, because this didn't do very well for them. Reuben that Eli, I would eat that in a hot, I mean, I love that stuff, man.
Reuben Benedict. Who doesn't want a Reuben Benedict?
Oh, it was just great. And it you know what, Eli, this was Eli's quickfire, right? Like just the whole concept. I'm going to be, you know, almost hangover food. It was brilliant. And then Michael Volta.
Can we talk for a second about another food confessions, which I feel like this entire season has just been my food confessions. I love Thousand Island Hollandaise as a concept because, Tom, I love processed Thousand Island dressing. You know what I like to do sometimes? Like whenever, like if we're road tripping or I it's very rare that I find myself in these spots just because, you know, I live in Los Angeles now and, you know, I usually go to big cities for travel. I'm not kind of in places where there's like the salad bar. Like when I was growing up, like the salad bar at Shoney's. I don't know if you guys had that.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
All right. So like, when I go like a pizza parlor where it's like, oh, and you get the free salad bar situation. I love Thousand Island dressing. And like there are times where if I'm ever in a situation where it's just like very basic salad bar, I'm going to top my iceberg lettuce in those little kind of mass like cherry tomatoes and those carrot shavings, you know, like the very basic of the basic side. Salad bars, and I'm gonna put about 3 gallons of Thousand
Island
dressing.
Soup with some leaflets,
right?
Of
because at the end of the day, if whenever possible, I want my salad to taste like a burger.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Thousand Island dressing. Also, is it synonymous with Russian dressing?
It basically is. I feel like Russian dressing is a little thinner and goopier. Is Thousand Island dressing, and it's got the little pickle thing going on there, you know, the little texture pickle thing.
In high school senior year, we would, you know, sneak off of campus, and I don't know if my mom's listening to this, but I doubt she is. But sorry, Mom, we used to sneak off campus and go to the deli, and we would smoke a joint before going to the deli, and we would eat a Philly cheese. We would order from the Khaleesi's deli a Philly cheesesteak with Russian dressing. And it was unfucking believably good. I loved it. It was like every Friday, it was just something to look forward to. And I guess this is second semester senior year, so I didn't really care about high school any at that point anymore. And it was amazing. And the Thousand Island Russian dressing aspect of it just made it 100 times better. It like when I would get Philly cheesesteak later on, I would always like ask, do you have any Russian dressing here by chance? So I'm with you on the Russian dressing, Thousand Island. My thing is though, like if you get an iceberg wedge and you order a wedge, are you going for the blue cheese or are you going with the Thousand Island?
I mean, I'm pretty much Thousand Island.
Already. Okay, you're team Thousand Island. Okay.
I mean, I love blue cheese dressing and I love blue cheese in general. What I'd like is blue cheese crumble with Thousand Island. that's how you service both needs. So this was good. I mean, Kevin does his steak and eggs, what's not to like, aged cheddar and green onion with a very soft scrambled egg. By the way, in keeping with food confessions, I want my scrambled eggs as wet and sloppy and soupy as possible. There's nothing worse than a hard scrambled egg.
Yeah. And like every time the thing about scrambled eggs is like, you always have to take it off about a minute or two earlier than you think, because it kind of congeals after, like you have to either
keeps cooking.
So anytime that Allison's making scrambled eggs or anyone's making scrambled eggs, I'm in the room. I always just be like, oh, that looks good. And they're like, it hasn't even solidified yet. And I'm like, just wait. If you 30 seconds later, it's going to be overdone and I don't want any part of that. So I am with you. I want a little bit of that, almost like a soup underneath when I see it.
It almost tastes like, it looks like, it kind of feels like cheesy eggs, even though it isn't.
That's kind of bad. Yeah. And we already talked about how you're three parts yolk and one part white on these things. And it makes it 100 times better. So I'm with the whole egg thing. Kevin did the steak and eggs. Michael Voltaggio did huevos cubano. You know,
Jen shitting on a single SOS beef.
All right. She walks into that, or does she know that Nigella is the host or the judge before she walks in there? Do they know that?
I don't think so.
Okay, because when she walks in there, I'm kind of like, don't do the shit on a shingle thing. Don't. Just say your dish. And maybe they won't put two and two together. But the idea of like, here's a shit on a shingle, this is Top Chef, and maybe they laugh it off. But I didn't want to have that imagery of a feces on a piece of wood. Like, that's my thing. Is like, even though it tastes really good, I just don't think you need the imagery. Am I being too much of a pansy here?
No. I mean, I hear what you're saying. The imagery is not great, clearly. But I'm just charmed with cream chopped beef because it is such like, and I love that she did it.
Yes.
Given her classical training. And it is kind of another guilty pleasure. I mean, basically, it is cream of beef. Like, what's better than cream of beef if you're, again, as hangover food goes? It is fun because I am a savory over sweet breakfast person. I just am, always will be, though I don't eat breakfast now. Speaking of which, that's how Brian got in trouble. Brian Beltaggio does a beautiful 4-minute egg, corn polenta, asparagus, and crab. Great combo, except does a vanilla beurre fondue, and the vanilla just kind of catches everybody off guard. Just is a little bit dissonant for the dish.
Is there anything more predictable than Brian Voltaggio doing a slow cooked egg or a slow roasted, you know, doing the king crab? He does it later in the episode where he's just got a very he knows what he's doing and doesn't get the quick fire once again. And you know, I think when Brian Voltaggio is in the bottom of a quick fire with Robin, that has to get in his head. I mean, he's so much better than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's already priced in the fact that he's not going to fare well in quick fires, and it does not really hinder his confidence. And I kind of like that about Brian. Like, he just knows they do not like him for quick fire. It is not his skill set. It is not going to be any indictment on him. He's just not going to win. He will often finish on the bottom, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lesser contestant would let it get inside their head. And Remember like when Randy Johnson would come to bat early in his career and he wouldn't even like kind of really, or no, it wasn't Randy Johnson. Who was it? I'm getting mixed up.
It might have been him, right? I kind of feel like he just put the bat on his shoulder and just stood there.
Right. But I feel like later in his career, he actually enjoyed hitting. But like just certain pitchers, they go up National League. They're just going to not even really. Like,
don't get me started.
They're going to be embarrassed and it's going to be, you know, and they're just going to go back to the dugout, come back out and pitch their game. And that's kind of who Valtaggio
is. And you know what, Kevin? This is why pitchers shouldn't be hitters. Anyway, next.
Yeah, we can debate that some other time. I kind of intellectually agree with you, but I do like the strategy that is demanded. But I've come a long way on that issue after being a National League.
It's because you're provincial. Like, that's all it is.
I'm not provincial. Who are you talking to?
You grew up watching a National League team, and so therefore you're only going to see things that way.
Yeah, why is it that American League fans are worldly and National League? You just grew up watching American League freaking baseball.
We can't do this now because this is going to be an hour-long show.
All right.
Just on that.
So anyway, so that's that. Eli wins. Good for Eli. He had the right dish at the right time for the right challenge. I'd like seeing him pick up a W. Good for him.
Yes.
And then we go into kind of an asinine premise for an elimination challenge, which is be inspired by a casino hotel. Like, the only thing I'm ever inspired by a casino hotel like that is to like drive back to Los Angeles and just, I don't know, go home and get inside my little Zen cave and be done with it.
I have a theory here, Kevin, is that they couldn't send Eli home because they gave him circus.
I mean, he could have probably done more with that with less.
There wasn't even a restaurant. There wasn't a
No, but I think, look, isn't there the, was, isn't, the just, shtick is these are goofy, kitschy. Like, Vegas is nothing but pure American kitsch, right? I mean, that's all it is. It is American kitsch. Like, the idea that there's a medieval-themed hotel for grown-ups is hilarious, right? Like, the idea that they try to recreate the early Renaissance, you know, is hilarious. The idea that they try to recreate Manhattan in the desert 2,500 miles to the southwest. Like, all of it. Mirage is kitsch. Mandalay Bay is kitsch. Circus is absolutely kitsch. And the idea is, hey, just kind of take an element from here and do it. Right?
And what is that element? What is going to the circus make you want to eat an amazing dish? Like, none of that. So they send him to circus, and I get that he's complaining about it and he's da-da-da-da. But if you're going to draft, okay, let's do it. Draft the six inspiration hotels, okay? There's easy. Mandalay Bay, Mirage, New York, Bellagio, Excalibur, and circus. Number one pick, Kevin, go.
It could be probably Mandalay Bay, because basically you just do seafood and you're in and out, right? Like, it doesn't even matter what seafood you do. Get it? It's Mandalay Bay. It's the ocean. Seafood. And you can do whatever fucking seafood you want. Like, it is the easiest spot on the board.
Okay.
What do you got?
Number two, I would take Mandalay Bay as well. Number two, I'm taking Bellagio, because you walk into that and you see the color. You can go a billion different ways with just seeing a whole bunch of color and flowers. I feel like that as a base to your dish, you can go a billion different ways. So I would go with the Bellagio number two.
Right. I mean, I'd probably go number three with New York, because basically you can do whatever the hell you want, right? Like, New York is basically anything American. You know, you get the Italian thing in New York. You can do Jew food if that's the way you want to go. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. New York, right? Like, you can do whatever the hell.
Rat pizza. Yeah. Like, you can do that too.
Yeah, you can do it.
New York. That's good. I will take that.
Yeah.
I would go probably Mirage number four.
What is the Mirage? You know, it's funny. Kevin did the Mirage and like, okay, what was the thing?
He didn't go. They didn't do anything. You know what it was? I think what happened here is they didn't do anything interesting at the Mirage, and they just asked Kevin to talk about what his philosophy is in cooking, because that's all he talked about. He was like, you know, I'm all about, like, you know, I don't do any foo-foo, like, you know, super complex things. I just keep things very simple and inspired and like all this stuff. And I was like, all right, so what about the Mirage? Like, what is the Mirage?
I mean, it's an oasis. So basically, what do you do? I cook with camel milk and dates, right? Like, I mean, that's what it's a desert.
Yeah.
Here's an empty plate.
That's, I don't know, garage, maybe, right? Maybe you do some crumble that kind of resembles sand, and then maybe a sand, little, exactly, like, broth.
You get a little Vantaggio. You could do one of those, like, you know, doesn't Brian Vantaggio do sand? Like a coffee sand?
Yeah.
Hasn't he done that on
dust,
like,
or whatever you do? Yeah, you know, like, you that's fine. But question is, Kevin, do you go Excalibur or Circus with your last pick?
I mean, I think you go Excalibur for this reason. You just get a massive freaking chicken leg or a massive hunk of meat. Now, the problem she had is it's for $175. And that's – so if it were just say, hey, I'm going to do a dish for the judges, you go get some tomahawk pork chops, right? And it's just like anything that's just like, arr, I, right, you know, sitting there style, with a – yeah, just – you know, it's medieval feast and there's a king sitting there with his big fucking turkey leg, right? Like, that's the thing. I mean, the problem is, of course, that you have 175 people, which is what she ran into. And then I guess circus, but let me say this about circus. All you have to do is just have a colorful plate and it would have sufficed, right? Like I think the judges totally buy in if it's just like these bright colors kind of, and you can do a little Jackson Pollock on the plate, right? Like just very bold, almost gratuitous color. And maybe there's a peanut like sauce with a satay or something. Like, here's what I would do.
Yeah, you know, go with the peanut. Yeah.
Go with a satay with a peanut sauce, right? And I don't know, the satay can have what other, give it one other little circusy element.
Well, popcorn or some, yeah, maybe some crunch with popcorn.
Yeah, whatever it is. I mean, I think if he had done a satay with peanuts, he's in the clear.
Doesn't really do him any favors that he served that in a cup. So what he made was a caramel apple and peanut soup with raspberry froth or something like that. And he served it in a little cup, and it just it didn't look appetizing. Where do you even begin with the commentary? I'll save that for later, because once we get to the judges' table, I have something I need to say. And then, all right, so he gets that circus, last pick on the board for us as a hotel. I feel for him that he didn't have any much to go with here, and I know everyone ragged on him because, oh, you're so dramatic, but I get it. Eli had the worst pick of all of them, coming off a quick fire, and he gets the short end of the stick. So whatever. Robin decides to do once again something she's never done before, because her brain is moving a million different directions and she has no vision. She doesn't know who she is as a chef, and she decides to do something that she has no fucking idea how to execute. So perfect. You've made it this far in the competition and you still haven't learned any of your lessons. So she does the sugar brittle type thing that it resembles the sculpture, the flowers, and you know, the Chihuly sculpture, I get it. That would be an inspiration, but don't do something you've never done before, especially this stage in the game, Kevin.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, if she could just make a freaking panna cotta, she'd be fine.
You're right.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I was shocked that she got sent home given the disaster that was Eli's dish. But I think when you start digging in, it's like, at the end of the day, the chef, these are professional chefs sitting around saying, we're 6 weeks out of crowning a champion, or six episodes out of crowning a champion, and this woman can't make a panna cotta, right? Like I think that was sort of what I gathered, you know, from it. I don't want to jump ahead because I know we'll have a conversation about the elimination table.
No, let's just do it here, Kevin. Okay. Let's just do it here. What, like, the fuck? They killed Eli. I'd rather eat sawdust. Personally, wouldn't want to eat that again. Texturally, completely failed. Again and again. Just absolutely eviscerated Eli. And then they send Robin home. If there's ever an example, Kevin, of this dish wasn't judged on its own merits, there was a memory here that there is actually the future. You know, we're whittling it down to only five contestants. Do we really want Robin here? I think this was, of any elimination I've ever seen on Top Chef, I thought this one was emblematic of there was other stuff being considered other than the dish in front of them. Agree or disagree?
I agree with you 100%. This was the judges clearly saying, Robin, you have excelled at being slightly less incompetent than a chef who's having a really bad day. And we're not going to stand for it anymore. Because once again, what happened this week? She was slightly less incompetent than a chef having his worst day, which has been her formula for survival in all of these sort of non-team challenges on the elimination level. And as you said, it's just there's a certain point where outrunning the other guy instead of outrunning the bear becomes patently offensive to those who put time into hosting and producing this show. And as you said, they were going to leave one heartbeat away from a finale, a contestant who by and large cannot execute some of the basics of professional cooking. And I think that's what happened, because I'm with you. This was, I mean, have they ever really said they're never informed by the past?
Yes. I feel like that's one of Tom's great, you know, ethos. It's just like we judge what's in front of us and we have a clear memory. We don't walk in. And I think there is some something to the effect of, you know, subliminal, you know, biases that, like, if Robin's going to give you a dish and then Michael Voltaggio gives you the same dish, you're probably going to side with Michael Voltaggio based on, you know, the Bayesian, like, theorem of chances are this is actually going to be a really good dish because it's Michael, right? Robin, I think that the judges just got to a point where they realized she is so much below the rest of the competition here. We need to get rid of her. And you know what? Maybe in the idea of, like, we need to crown the best chef here, that makes some sense. That rationale, I get it. But in terms of I'm only judging the dish that they served us today, Robin in no way served a worse dish.
No, she didn't. But she couldn't execute what Tom, when I tell you, like, making panna cotta is basically making jello pudding, like, from the little pouch. I mean, it is really easy. Now, I'm not going to say if you don't know the cooking and, you know, and the conditions and the stovetop and a lot of people, I understand there are some limitations, but I think there's a good chance your friend Kevin had a puncher's chance in beating Robin in a panna cotta cook-off for 175 people. Like, it's just not that hard. I'm not a dessert guy, but what I know about panna cotta is that it is there's a reason you see it a lot on these shows, because it requires very few ingredients, very little prep. It just, you don't have to do a lot of anything other than put cream and sugar in a freaking little, those little thingies. I mean, like it just doesn't require all that much.
No. And she couldn't execute. And once again, she tried to do something she's never done before. And Tom made the point. So you did something you've never done before.
You know what? No. Yeah, let me just say this about that. Yes. And Tom, like, maybe, how about this? You're a professional chef. How about actually nail something you've never done before? Like if your entire criteria going into an elimination challenge is, okay, I can only do things I've done before, then what are you doing on the show? I mean, that's sort of the thing. Like, I know look, if you're a game theorist and you're her coach and you're like Mickey in the corner of the boxing ring, like, you know, advising her, yeah, maybe for your survival, don't do anything you've done before, but like, God
forbid.
She does
it every time, Kevin.
Right, but God forbid you actually be able to have the instincts as a chef to pull off something you've never done before. Like, every week, these chefs go out there and do things they haven't done before.
This is Andrew Bynum shooting threes at practice. Every day at practice. It's not that she can't improvise and do her own thing every once in a while. It's that she mindlessly, just dizzyingly, does something that she has never done before every single time, and she's gotten by. And I'm just saying, like, I trust Andre Iguodala and LeBron James and Luka Doncic to improvise every once in a while and do something that is kind of outside of their comfort zone. That's fine. But still, give me the drives to the basket, because that's what you do. She doesn't drive to the basket. She's never doing the thing that she's good at. And I don't know.
What is she good at? No, I'm not trying to be snide. Like, yeah, I mean, what is she good at? I mean, what is she, you know, it's this, oh, I do home cooking, or I do kind of just comfort cooking. But I haven't seen a lot of comfort food. Mm. Like, I haven't seen, you know, like, take Kevin's thing, right? Which is he does that big vegetarian sort of yummy kale mushroomy thing. Like, that's comfort food. Like, to me, Kevin does comfort food. That's not the, I don't want to, I don't want to denigrate it. I mean, because that some chefs might take offense to comfort food being this sort of, you know, distinction from, you know, sort of professional food, like, or that it can be done without sufficient training or anything. But like, I don't, like, she doesn't really do anything. But my point is that, you know, at a certain point, the flourishes on the show by these chefs are often things they haven't done before that they nail. Like, I don't know. I'm just a regular old home cook, right? I'm doing some nice things. I'm proud of myself. And you know what? Once a week, I do something I've never done before and I get it right. Like, that's what's called growing up as a chef, right? Like, each week you do something new you've never done before and you get it right. Some weeks you do something you've never done before and you screw it up. And then the next week you do it right. But like, she's never done anything she's never done before and done it right. Like, the idea that you should limit yourself to only things you've done means you probably don't belong on the show. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting a little.
Well, yes. Now let's spend a little, before we go into where are they now? Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the winners. So Kevin, Michael Voltaggio, Brian Voltaggio get in the top three. Michael wins with the chicken wings. And I was stunned by that because I thought chicken wings was a little bit like.
You have my complaints.
Michael Voltaggio doing chicken wings. And like, I didn't even think that Toby Young actually liked it, like the blue cheese disc or whatever. My thing was, it looked good. It tasted good, but were the other two dishes really that poor that Michael won with chicken wings?
All right. So I have a couple comments. One is the chicken wing is from Buffalo, New York, not NY. Buffalo is much closer to Cleveland. Hell, it's closer to Pittsburgh.
Okay. Statue of Liberty is actually not in New York either.
Well, I mean, that's Staten Island, God, you know, like, but the thing is that, yeah, it's Buffalo is a different place. So I don't want to be the well actually guy, but yeah. It's just well, yeah. Actually, okay. Like okay. It is decidedly not a New York City food. There's nothing. I mean, Buffalo is in New York. So I guess, you know, you get that. I think my read is that cured salmon's, I mean, I know he did beautiful tomato water. My interpretation was his cured salmon is a little bit of a degree of difficulty, easiness commentary by them. Like it just isn't that hard to lightly cure salmon and kind of serve it over a salad of compressed vegetables. The tomato water is nice and clear. Oh, it's, man, a great dish.
Sounds great to me.
You know, the escabeche of halibut furthers my evidence that it is hard to do amazing halibut. It is just such a lean, flaky fish that is wonderful for a light eat. You know, the pine nuts and garlic chips, like, clearly a good dish. But I don't know, if you confit some boneless wings and you do it with a nice curry and pepper sauce, like, it might just have been tastier than, you know, halibut, which is halibut, and, you know, cured salmon, which is cured salmon.
I also think, Kevin, I don't know where you stand on this, but I kind of like the bones in my chicken wings. Like, if you give me just the meat off of a chicken wing, it kind of takes the fun out of it. Like, I know, I feel like you're more of the, just give me the lobster meat, don't give me the fucking lobster.
No. Hey, don't make assumptions about it.
Okay.
I am a very serious wing eater, Tom. As you know, my partner is from Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Latrobe is home to Dino's, and Dino's has been ranked one of the best wings in Western Pennsylvania.
Ooh.
Western Pennsylvania being kind of Buffalo adjacent. And it is good. And I do. Now, one of the things I will say this, I do prefer that little drumlet wing rather than that one that has the little, you kind of got to get your tongue inside the two little like wires. I'm not as into that wing because that gets a little frustrating. And then you get your hands all schmutzig and all that. But like, I do like the drumlet. Really do. The other one, I like, there is a satisfaction. Also, I do like to eat the bone. Like, I am somebody who will gnaw on that bone like a dog.
Wait.
I sound like Trump, like a dog. Like a dog, I gnaw on that bone.
Wait, you actually like eat the bone, or you like to gnaw on top of the bone? Like,
on top of, you know, like, you get some of the bone is soft and edible, Tom. You can kind of eat a little bit of the bone.
Yeah, my dad is a big bone eater.
I kind of like eating the bone. I will admit it. I like eating the bone.
So I love eating chicken wings. And so the idea of a boneless chicken wing is just basically in my head is just a chicken nugget. And it offends me a little bit is the idea that you take away the bones. Like, half of the fun is just being a medieval, you know, Neanderthal, just eating a caveman eating the chicken wing. So that also kind of irked me a little bit. But I guess that's Michael Voltaggio. So, he wins, he gets, no, sorry. he does win. He gets the bottle of Terlato wine and goes a prize to Napa to tour the vineyard, which sounds lovely. Any other things before we get to where are they now?
No, just that I'm purely loving Toby Young and his sensibility. Like many people in Las Vegas, he has gambled and lost.
And lost. Yes. I had that underlined on here. Yeah.
He's wonderful. And look, I know he's kind of I know he's radioactive right now in certain corners of the opinion world, but like, I want more Toby Young on my Top Chef. I want them to bring him back. He is fantastic. And I like him being at the judge's table. There's just a dry, ironic wit that you need on cooking shows. Like, don't get me wrong, I love Gail Simmons's earnestness. Like, I really do. I want that. I want the diverse ecosystem of judges. I want the earnest. I want the ironic. I want the sort of the ambassador of goodwill, and I want the bitchy. Like, I want...
Yeah, you want the Simon Cowell every once in a while. Yeah.
I just want a full complement of judicial voices. And I love Toby Young. Like, he's just hilarious. And he has gambled and lost.
And like most people who come to Las Vegas, he has gambled and lost. I'm with you. If I could listen to someone review food, a local McDonald's, I would, or even the highest of fine dining, I would love to listen to Toby Young of maybe all of those judges. Anyway, we've got Robin Leventhal, Chef Robin, goes home, and I was curious to see where are they now with Robin. And it turns out that she, when this season aired of Top Chef, her restaurant that she had owned and ran, Crave, had shut down by the time it aired. So there wasn't this like honeymoon phase that a lot of Top Chefs get to feel is, you know, get that glow, the afterglow of Top Chef. But what she did do, which was interesting, is she became the chef instructor at Walla Walla Community College, which apparently to the Seattle Times is 2 years running the number one community college in America.
Yeah, Walla Walla is out actually sort of in central. It's a very deserty region of Washington State. People don't realize like Washington State has this sort of deserty, like kind of central strip with the Tri-Cities, Walla Walla. A lot of apple orchards around Walla Walla. But yeah.
Good for her.
It's fun to say Walla Walla.
Yeah, there's a little like tune in my head. Walla Walla, Washington, Kalamazoo, like something like that. What is that? Do you know what that is?
I am not familiar with the work, no.
Oh, I think maybe it's a nursery rhyme or something like that with Madeline. I don't know. But the she went out there and kind of got in touch with a little bit of her rural side or outdoor. It's not the city life of Seattle like she had been with Crave. So Robin was quite the heel on this season of Top Chef.
Kind of less a heel, more of like a piggy in Lord of the Flies. Like, I think of heel as being almost performatively villainous.
I don't know. She was a little bit performative. Like, I don't know. She would overreact to a lot of
things. I have to say, like, in one of her last offenses, I'm kind of with Michael Voltaggio. Like, when he comes in to the kitchen to follow her, like, I am so Michael Voltaggio that I can't even deal with my own mess. Like, I'm imagining, like, coming into the kitchen to cook and having all that shit just everywhere. Like, I would have been – he was nicer than I would have been. I'm really, really fastidious and weird about, like in other people's filth. Like, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, so
like, you know our friend Ethan out in Oakland?
Of course.
Did you ever ride in his car, like, during the Warriors? Yeah. Like, you know what I'm talking about?
His old car is pretty...
Yeah, his old car. His old car.
His old car.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it was a tornado had hit his car.
You combine it with the dog hair. And look, I'm getting a golden retriever, so I'm going to be contending with my own dog hair issues. But it was just like, it took all the discipline in the world and like large-heartedness, like not to insult him and like say, I'll take a cab. like, where are we going next? Like, it just, but that's sort of how cooking after Robin in that kitchen must have felt.
Yeah. And then she was in there in the space trying to clean up, which I, you know what? She was trying to clean up. So maybe, you know, give her a couple, a pat on the back for that. But she, he wanted nothing to do with her. He was just like, get your stuff is everywhere and you're here. So it was a double whammy. Kevin, I don't, maybe we'll get some answers if we interview one of the chefs on the show, what the deal is with the 6-person hostel, sleeping arrangements on this episode. I don't really know what was going on, but really one of the black eyes of the show is that Robin on one hand she should have been voted off because of her prior performance. But on this episode, I really thought Eli should have gone home. But he lives another day, and the bear has eaten Robin.
Yes, fine. For Tom Habistro, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.